In Genesis 15, we concluded with these observations. The first one, the Lord makes a covenant with Abram, verses 9 through 11. And a covenant simply is a commitment. It is a solemn agreement or promise, sometimes confirmed by sacrifice or by sharing in a meal, by which two or more parties commit themselves to the rights and responsibilities demanded by their relationship and their agreed course of action, and accept the serious consequences of breaking faith. So basically, if you think of a covenant, think of two C's about that: commitment and consequences. A very good illustration for a covenant would be the covenant of marriage. It is a solemn promise by a man and a woman before the presence of God and in the presence of the community of believers, confirmed by and joined by God through the minister officiating the wedding ceremony. And when one party sins or breaks the vow, breaks the covenant, there are serious consequences that will follow. The covenant of God to Abram is comprised of three things: the land of Canaan, or I should say Canaan, to be precisely pronunciating that word, but I'm not consistent in that, so you'll hear me say either or later. The land of Canaan. God also promised that Abraham would be the father of a nation, and with this promise also comes a promise of a relationship with him and this nation. Another observation we got out of that is Abram falls asleep, verse number 12. In the middle of this mysterious covenant, he falls asleep in the middle of a covenant ceremony. And the Bible tells us that an horror of great darkness fell upon him. The horror of great darkness seems to point to the delay of the fulfillment of God's promise. It seems to point to the delay of God's promise, the fulfillment of God's promise. We're not talking like, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for taking a Southwest flight. We regret to inform you that our flight is being delayed for 40 minutes. It's 400 years of delay. And I think that's probably why this darkness, this horror of darkness came upon him, with the mixed feelings of like, wow, that's kind of far off. It's not happening like tomorrow, Lord. I'm happy and I'm blessed to be blessed by you, but it's not happening until later on, hundreds of years later. I think that was the point of the great darkness falling upon him. And then a third observation that we concluded with is that the Lord answers Abram's question, verses 13 through 21. God answers Abram's question, telling him, your descendants are going to be slaves in a foreign land. That's another aspect why this great darkness fell upon him, because his descendants are going to be slaves in a foreign land and will be slaves there for 400 years. All right? So, we finished Genesis 15. We're going now into Genesis 16. And I have entitled this, Abram's Wife's Faith, Genesis 16. But before we go there, let me give you a homework assignment. A homework assignment. I thought I put it up here on the screen, but it's not. So here it is. I think it's on your outline Yeah, it is on your outline there. Homework for next week is this. Question, how did people in the Old Testament get saved? I think that's a very interesting question. And the clue that you have here is the next question. What was the nature of Abram's faith? And if you'd like to study this out, which I am challenging you to, write these verses down. Genesis 15:6 is the first one. Genesis 15:6. And Romans chapter 4. Romans chapter 4. You will also find a reference of Abram's faith in James 2:19-24. James 2:19-24. And if you're really, really, really brave, you can also look at Hebrews 11:8-13. Hebrews 11:8-13. So that is your homework for this week. All right, great. I didn't know I enrolled for this class, but you are. You are in this class. Don't worry, I won't give you a grade. Pastor Coleman will give you a grade for that. So today we are in Genesis 16. And we're going to read the entire chapter here. It's only 16 verses, so let's go ahead and start that right now. Now, Sarai, Abram's wife, bare him no children, and she had an handmaid, an Egyptian, whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said unto Abram, behold now, the Lord hath restrained me from bearing. I pray thee, go into my maid. Go in unto my maid, it may be that I may obtain children by her. And Abram hearkened to the voice of Sarai. And Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan, and gave her to her husband, Abram, to be his wife. And he went in unto Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her eyes. And Sarai said unto Abram, my wrong be upon thee. I have given my maid into thy bosom, and when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between me and thee. In other words, God's going to get you for this. But Abram said unto Sarai, behold, my maid is in thy hand. Thy maid is in thy hand. Do to her as it pleaseth thee. And when Sarai dealt hardly with her, she fled from her face. And the angel of the Lord found her by a fountain of water in the wilderness, by the fountain in the way to Shur. And he said, Hagar, Sarai's maid, whence camest thou, and whither wilt thou go? And she said, I flee from the face of my mistress Sarai. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, return to thy mistress, and submit thyself under her hands. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, I will multiply thy seed exceedingly, that it shall not be numbered for multitude. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, behold, thou art with child, and shalt bear a son, and shalt call his name Ishmael, because the Lord hath heard thy affliction, and he will be a wild man. His hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him, and he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. And she called the name of the Lord that spake unto her, thou God seest me. For she said, have I also here looked after him that seeth me? Wherefore, the well was called Be'er Lahai-Roi. Behold, it is between Kadesh or Kadesh and Bered. And Hagar bare Abram a son, and Abram called his son's name, which Hagar bare, Ishmael. And Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bare Ishmael to Abram. That is the word of the Lord. And may he bless it in our hearing. We were introduced to Sarai briefly in chapters 11 and 12 with the description that Sarai was barren. Abram's description of her is that she was a fair woman to look upon. In the original, it says, "A woman beautiful of appearance are you." A fair woman to look upon. The Egyptians' description of her is similar. They said she was very fair. There should be no doubt then in our minds, in the audience minds, of this narrative that Sarai was a very beautiful woman. Her beautiful appearance was her power. That was her master weapon of influence over other people. In chapter 16, we are reintroduced to Sarai again. She is still Abram's wife, and she still is barren. And she still did bear him no children. Moreover, here's an additional information that we have about Sarai. And it is this: she had an Egyptian slave by the name of Hagar. I want us to observe then the kind of faith Abram's wife's faith was like. And this chapter answers for us how Sarai displayed her faith in God. Her faith in God was, number one, what I would call lordship priority. Lordship priority in reference to the Lord, in reference to God. It is important to note that Sarai's faith, what she is speaking here when she speaks, she preludes it with a lordship priority. Sarai preludes her proposal to Abram with an affirmation that God is Lord of baby production. In other words, she is affirming this statement. Without the mighty and powerful hand of God in procreation, the womb remains shut. Okay? It is no wonder that the psalmist said in Psalm 139, 14 through 15, notice this statement, "I will praise thee. I will praise thee, O Lord, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul, every fiber of my being, it is innate within me, this knowledge that my soul knoweth well, my substance, every fiber of my being was not hid from thee, when I was made in secret and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth." That's a metaphor for the woman's womb. Did you see that? When Sarah says here, verse number 2, Sarai said unto Abram, behold now, look here, dear, the Lord. She preludes what she was about to propose to Abram, lordship, priority, and acknowledgement that God is mighty and sovereign over even baby production. But I sense a little self-pity in Sarah's tone of voice. She said, the Lord hath restrained me from bearing. Now, it was a factual statement, but it seems focused on self. Lordship priority should be a primary facet in one's faith, but it must maintain a focus on the Lord, not on self. Remember Hannah? Hannah, the mother of Samuel, prophet Samuel. She recognized and she acknowledged the Lord had shut up her womb. But she prayed unto the Lord and wept sore. She prayed unto the Lord. The focus one was unto the Lord. And she wept sore. Do we see a record of Sarai praying to God? Do we see a record of her weeping very sorely over her barrenness and claiming the promise of God? No, we don't. Why? Because that would involve a supernatural element, wouldn't it? It would involve a supernatural element, wouldn't it? Which brings us to a contrast in Sarah's approach. And her approach was this. It was logical in practice. The conversation might have gone this way. I'm Sarah, okay? Abram, darling, I'm not very good at this. Look now, dear. I acknowledge that the Lord is mighty powerful. He can open up my womb and give me a child. The fact of the matter is, darling, he hasn't. Behold now, Abram. You're getting to be pretty old. I'm getting to be pretty old as well. So logically, there has to be another way that the Lord's promise will be fulfilled. Am I saying that intelligent thinking is bad and to be avoided at all cost? No, I'm not saying that. Not at all. Faith has to be intelligent. Faith has to involve intellect. Faith has to have logic. Faith must have some logic in it. But logic is not enough. I'm not saying that faith is illogical. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying faith is supra-logical. It goes beyond logic. It doesn't defy logic. It doesn't violate logic. It goes above it and beyond it. Sarai's approach was primarily logical at this point. And then she threw some science in there too, didn't she? She threw in some science in there as well. Well, what do I mean? She says, our biological clocks, right? Abram, they're winding down. They're ticking down near its end. Now, Abram's wife was not only captivatingly beautiful, she was persuasively, logically intelligent. Very smart. There are ladies that are very, very smart. She went on to say, "It may be that I may obtain children by Hagar," which gives us another facet to her kind of faith. And that is, the third one here is, her faith is lacking of patience. We have reasons to believe that Sarai had full knowledge of the covenant promises of God to Abram. You agree with that statement? She had full knowledge of what God had promised Abram. For one, I think it was the narrator's intent to introduce Sarai with a predicament. The narrator, the writer of Genesis, I believe it's Moses, introduces us to Sarai with a very brief description of a problem, that she was barren. She was introduced with that predicament to alert the readers that this, or she, was going to play a major role in the development of Abram's faith. And then for another reason, I think Abram told her all his experiences, told her his encounters with God. I mean, that's just how I would assume a good couple would do. They would talk about what the Lord is talking or the Lord is doing in their lives and share those experiences. And so I think Sarai had full knowledge of what God promised to Abram. But there is lack of patience on her part. And it is apparent in her proposal to her husband. In essence, she was saying, "Abram, I can't wait till I'm old and gray, and it's actually here sooner than you think. So what you're going to do, Abram," she was a very beautiful lady, okay? Captivatingly so. And she used that powerful magnetism to influence her husband to follow what she proposed. "Abram, what you're going to do is marry this girl and have your child of promise." It was still laden with God things. It was still, she thinks, in alignment with God's will. "I can't wait for God. He's late. If he wanted me to be the one to carry your child, then he would have blessed me by yesterday." Sarai's intelligent logic brought her to a lack of patience and to this proposal. Watch carefully. In essence, again, she's saying, "Abram, technically speaking, the promise is given to you. And about your child. So technically, if you take Hagar to be your wife and have a child with her, technically, God would still be technically faithful to his promise." You hear anybody else reason like that in the previous chapters of Genesis? Some of you are shaking your head, so let me remind you, okay? Go to Genesis chapter 3. Genesis chapter 3. Let's look at that real quick. And This is not in my notes, so we're just going to go through this really quickly, just to remind you to recall in our memory, somebody reasoned exactly the same way. Yes. Yes. Where is that? Well, now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made, and he said unto the woman, yea, hath God said, ye shall not eat of every tree of the garden? And the woman said unto the serpent, we may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God hath said, ye shall not eat of it, neither shall ye touch it, lest ye die. And the serpent said unto the woman, technically, ye shall not surely die. All right. Now, it is, I think, the intent of the narrator, the writer here, Moses, and inspired by the Holy Spirit of God, God intended for the readers, for us to make similar observations of what took place in Genesis 3 of the woman and of Genesis 16 of the woman. Similarities there, but that's another class. But I want you to keep that in mind, because you will see that in chapter 16 throughout. Now, not only that this facet of Sarai's faith is lacking of patience, it is looking towards presumption. It is leaning towards presumption as well. What do I mean by that? What presumption did Sarai lean towards? What is she presuming here? Or what is she assuming? Or what is a preconceived notion here? What is a presupposition that she has about God? What is there? Yes, yes, sir. Very good observation. The presumption is that God cannot do miracles. That God was only going to use natural means to bring about his blessings, to fulfill his promises to Abram. It is the presumption, get this, and I'm going to put a nuance to that statement just a little bit, so I can understand this, and we can relate to this. It is the presumption that God thinks the same way we think. It is the presumption that God does things the way we do things. Oh boy, oh boy. I'll be the first one to admit to you I've done that many, many times in my Christian life. That he is just like us. That God is just like us. That is perhaps the most, or one of the most dangerous presumptions that people have. People do this all the time. Our society displays this all the time. How do you know? Well, a very popular example would be something like calling God the man upstairs. He is not the man upstairs. He is God of heaven and of earth. You know, statements like that displays an attitude towards God that says He is just like us. It is a presumption that God does the same way we do things. Listen, and we've said it many times here. God is different. God is set apart. We are aliens to Him. Theologians refer to this as this statement, God is holy. Have you ever heard that? God is holy. He is distinct. He is set apart. He is high and lofty. Listen to how Isaiah describes God. In Isaiah 40. And I'd like to read it with a little bit of commentary to it. Isaiah 40, beginning in verse 18. And he sets forth very directly here what is to be thought about God. He says, "To whom then will ye liken God? Or what likeness will ye compare unto Him?" And then he gives some comparison of what or how people do this. "The workman meldeth a graven image, and the goldsmith spreadeth it over with gold and casteth silver chains. He that is so impoverished that he hath no oblation chooseth a tree that will not rot." Okay, this worker, this idol, image graver, engraver, would go out there to choose the best tree to make his God out of. "Chooseth a tree that will not rot. He seeketh unto him a cunning workman to prepare a graven image that shall not be moved." In other words, he's making sure that this idol that he's creating, making sure that it doesn't fall over. "Have ye not known? Have ye not heard? Hath it not been told you from the beginning? Have ye not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is He that sitteth upon the circle of the earth, and the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers, that stretcheth out the heavens as a curtain, and spreadeth them out as a tent to dwell in. And it is He that bringeth the princes to nothing." It means He reduces the leaders of this world, the prominent people in this world, He reduces them to nothing. "It is He who bringeth the princes to nothing. He maketh the judges of the earth as vanity, insignificant. Yea, they that shall not be planted. Yea, they that shall not be sown. Yea, their stock shall not take root in the earth, and He shall also blow upon them, and they shall wither, and the whirlwind shall take them away as stubble. To whom then will ye liken Me, or shall I be equal, saith the Holy One?" Lift up your eyes on high, and behold who hath created these things. It's pointing to the heavenly lights, the heavenly stars. "That bringeth out their host by number. He calleth them all by names, by the greatness of His might, for that He is strong in power, not one faileth." That's the kind of God, is the God who made a covenant with Abram. And what is being referred to here, what's being alluded to here, is the greatest miracle of all. And that is the creation of the universe. And it has already been done. Right? It's already been done. The creation of the world has already been done. Any tiny miracle of giving a baby to great-grandparent aged couple would not be too hard or impossible. But to be honest with you, I think and I thought like Sarai thought. And if you're honest with me this morning, you can look back in your life and recall instances in your life when you thought like Sarai thought. Sarai sized up her situation, and her presumption of God was a pretty dangerous one. And so, we're done with Sarah at this time. We move into how did Abram size up her faith? Did you hear Abram's answer? Did you notice his answer? Two words that have put the entire human race in a world of mess. Yes, dear. Hear anybody else answer like that in the previous chapter of Genesis? Adam. The narrator summed it up this way. Abram hearkened to the voice of Sarai. And everything else that followed, were the consequences and the outworking of a faith that is wrong. Everything else that followed after Adam said, "Yes, dear," was a mess of a world and a world of a mess. Look at the list of the consequences. Genesis 16. On the wrong faith. Genesis 16. Let's see. Verse number 3. Polygamous relationship. Verse 4. Unwanted pregnancy. Unwanted by the first wife. Verse 5. Contempt on the part of Hagar against her mistress. Verse 5. Again, more self-pity on the part of Sarai. Verse 5. Yet again, blame shifting. Reminiscent of a woman blaming the serpent, man blaming the woman. Verse number 6, irresponsibility on the part of Abram. And we have a word for that, passivity on part of men. I'm tired of you nagging me about this problem. Do whatever you want. Verse 6, harshness on Sarai's part. Verse 6 again. The poor servant girl runs away. We get the picture, right? Sin has consequences. Pastor James said this: "Then when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin. And sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. And the ultimate consequence of sin is death in all level of life, whether it be physically, spiritually, emotionally, relationship, so on and so forth. Death and all of that. But thank the Lord, there is redemption." I mean, just the similarities here between chapter 3 and 16 is so close. Where do we find that? Verse number 7. Verse number 7 and following introduce us to the angel of the Lord. The first mention of this character, the angel of the Lord. This is not just an ordinary angel. This is not some ordinary cherubim or seraphim sent out from the throne of God. This is actually the appearance of Jesus Christ before he was Jesus Christ. Well, how do we know that? This is what theologians refer to as a theophany or a Christophany, which means basically an appearance of God, a visible manifestation of God or his glory. How do we know this angel of the Lord is indeed God? This angel of the Lord is indeed Jesus Christ of Nazareth before he was Jesus Christ of Nazareth. Well, for one, look at verse 10. Verse 10 says, the angel of the Lord said unto her, what are those two words next? I will. I will. What do those two words represent? Those two words is what we call a prerogative. A prerogative, a special capability of God, not of anybody else. You remember one supreme, high and mighty angel attempted to do the same? I will do this. I will do that. And what happened to him? Cast it out. This is a prerogative of God. And then, the angel of the Lord then told Hagar to humble yourself and submit to Sarai, in verse 9. But she's mean to me, Hagar says. She's mean to me. Yes, even if she's mean to you, you still go. Verse 10 tells us God will multiply her seed exceedingly. In verse 11, Hagar is to name her son Ishmael. Now, how did the angel of the Lord know that? They didn't have ultrasound back then. Another prerogative of God, which is omniscience. Verse 12 is a further elaboration of what kind of man her child was going to be. Again, an angel of the Lord, a regular, ordinary angel of the Lord, might not have known that. But this one seems to know exactly what's going to happen to this child. Which is a further evidence of God's omniscience. Verses 13 and 14 informs us that Hagar recognized the Lord, and she called the name of the Lord, Thou God seest me. That's a long name. That's four words. That's a long name for God. Thou God seest me. Which is a translation of Be'er Lahai Roy. Say that 10 times. Which means, Thou God seest me. What was she referring to? She was referring to the angel of the Lord. And she was calling him, you, God, sees me. Be'er lahaloi. By verse 15, the narrator didn't have to tell us. Hagar was redeemed, at least in the physical sense. And she went back to Sarai. She humbled herself and submitted to Sarai. Hagar carried the baby full term and gave birth to a son. Oh, what do you know? The prediction of the angel of the Lord came true. And then, interestingly, it was Abram who named him. How did he know about the name? Well, Hagar probably told him, or maybe it just happened that way because the angel of the Lord, again, is omniscient, the all-knowing God. And then, verse 16 tells us, Abram was fourscore and 6 years old when Hagar bare Ishmael to Abram. We come now to our concluding application. And what is that? What did you get out of this class? I think I left some blanks there for you to write your application. It's basically what the Holy Spirit is impressing upon your life. Out of the observations and the meanings and interpretation of this chapter, what is the Holy Spirit impressing upon your life for you to do? Okay? That's the application. Let me just suggest a general one here. It's kind of like a broad stroke application for all of us to ponder. Abram's wife's faith was a wrong kind of faith. Although it started with a lordship priority, it was ridden with logic in practice. It was riddled with a lack of patience and leaned towards a presumption that was dangerously blasphemous. It was a wrong kind of faith because its object primarily was logic, not the Lord. And we must beware of this kind of faith, which was not faith at all, but human ingenuity apart from the divine power of the God who sees you and everything else. Let's close in prayer. Our Father.